Ahmad Badawi is an award-winning broadcaster, journalist, and filmmaker. She's president of SOAS University of London and is an honorary fellow of her alma mater, St Hilda's College, Oxford. Born in Sudan, she has worked in the British media for several decades. Zainab is a recipient of the President's Medal of the British Academy, a patron of the United Nations Association UK, and is on the boards of the Arts, Humanities and Research Council, MINDS, which is the Mandela Institute for Development Studies, the International Crisis Group, and Afrobarometer. She was previously chair of the Royal African Society. An African History of Africa is her first book. Welcome, Zainab.
Hello. My name is Katie Razzle. I'm the culture and media editor at BBC News. Vanessa's actually done the beginning of my job for me because obviously she needs no introduction, but we are all here to hear Zainab Badawi, an amazing person, an amazing, it turns out, writer as well, because this is a really, really, really good book, and I'm not just saying that. And Zainab said she was very surprised that I'd actually read it. I said, of course I've read it. I'm doing an interview with you. Of course I've read it. Anyway, I'm sure it doesn't say anything about your preparation for these sorts of things, Zainab. It's wonderful to have you here. This book is, you know, clearly from the title, is giving a perspective, an African perspective on history. I speak from my perspective, and I don't know, probably lots of people in the room, that our knowledge, even now, of African history is actually incredibly European or Europe-centred. How did it come about for you that you wanted to write this book? What drove you to it?
All right. First of all, I just say hello, everybody. It's lovely to be with you. Thank you, Chalk Festival, for hosting me. Good of you to have provided a Bedouin tent and the African sun, just to make me really in the mood. Thank you. So, Katie, thank you also for coming to chair this conversation with me. In a way, the book found me, Katie, because, like you, I've worked in television for many years, and over the period of about 7 years, I embarked on a project which was to make 20 45-minute films about the history of Africa. And I went to more than 30 African countries to do so. It's available free of charge on BBC YouTube. And I talked to scores and scores of African historians, archaeologists, paleontologists, you name it. And I came away thinking, you know what, I don't feel I've done justice to them. You know what it's like, so much of what an interviewee says hits the cutting room floor. And I was also struck by another thing, which is, in a way, this book could have been called Don't Worry, No Problem, because every time I arrived at an appointment for with one of the historians, I'd invariably be late because of the vagaries of the traffic, you know, in African cities. But they always were so polite and generous with their time, and I had to literally drag myself away from each interview. And I thought, there's something going on here. They know I came from the BBC, that I was making this TV series, but they were so enthusiastic and keen to tell me their history. So that, coupled with the idea that I felt I hadn't really ventilated their scholarship enough in the series, made me think, I've got to try and write a book about Africa's history, putting the African academic center stage. Because as you rightly say, there have been many good books about African history written by some people whom I consider to be close friends, the Africanists. But the African historian in a kind of popular general readership has really been absent from our bookshelves. So in a way, I wrote the kind of book that I wanted to read. And then again, as you say quite rightly, Katie, that Africa's history has on the whole been written by outsiders, denigrated, or Africans have been told they don't have any history. And often people start African history from the presence of the Europeans. And I wanted to go way back to do as much pre-colonial history as I could. So those
you
were the factors.
You start 7 million years ago.
I do.
So you go. She goes quite a long way.
I do. I start chapter one with the origins of humankind because I know it sounds a bit idealistic, but in this world which is becoming increasingly divided, I wanted to focus on our undivided past to say, look, today you're either an African living in Africa, or you're a member of the African diaspora, such as myself, or you're an African export because everybody came out of Africa. You know, the debate is settled. Nobody on earth today cannot say Africa is not their mother continent. And so I wanted to start with that, to emphasize our common origins, our common humanity. And that's why I do go back to that in chapter one.
Absolutely. And I mean, you're saying that most of us get our history from when the Europeans arrived. And I definitely am aware that, you know, when you think about Africa, quite often what you're thinking about is, what do I know? Oh, the scramble for Africa or slavery or whatever it might be. And actually, in your book, there are so many just incredible stories of an incredible, different countries, but incredible stories of people. And I was very drawn to quite a lot, to the female stories in your book. There's amazing Queen, and I'm going to get Njinga of Ndongo from the 16th and 17th century, who not only fought the Portuguese, but then escaped at one point across a precipice on vines.
Yes, vine leaves. She abseiled, yeah.
Tell us about her, because she was rather fabulous.
So she was a remarkable woman and one of my favourites too. I should just say by way of a preface that I have written the book very largely, a kind of micro-history, looking at characters, personalities, in order to talk about that particular aspect of history, because I think that, as Macaulay said, history is best understood, or as the Chalk Festival demonstrates, history is best understood if it's seared into the imagination, and that's best done through personalities. So Queen Njinga was born in 1583 in what would today be called Angola, and she was a really feisty woman, lived to her early 80s, and just dodged the Portuguese at every turn. And she was opposed to the presence of the Portuguese, which was growing in that part of Central Africa, in both what is the Congo today, the DRC, as well as Angola. And to just give you an example of her character, her brother, who was king, said to her, look, go and see the governor, the Portuguese governor of Luanda, and just intercede on our behalf and tell him to leave our kingdom alone and to stop taking enslaved people from our lands. So she said, okay. So she goes decked in, you know, beautiful finery, jewelry, and her most beautiful clothes, and goes with this huge retinue to go and see the Portuguese governor, who receives her in his tent. He's sitting on a velvet chair embossed with gold, and there's a rug on the floor, and, you know, she's expected to sit on that. And she thinks, I'm not going to sit on that because I'm going to be so much lower than he is. So she calls one of her female attendants, tells her to go on all fours, and sits on this poor unfortunate woman for all 4 hours of negotiations without her moving. And then she was, you know, at eye level with the Portuguese governor. And, you know, like I said, she died with her kingdom intact. And 20,000 people turned up to her funeral, and there she lay with her crown on her head. So, yes, it's a very invigorating story, but putting women as I can. I try to do that. I think sometimes people take the HIS in history too seriously. His story. Sometimes
Absolutely.
Let's make it her story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you do in this book, and I've taken you immediately, and I'm embarrassed to say I've taken you immediately to a character that is involved in the European story. We could go
That's
back
right,
earlier
though, yeah.
to the Kushite queen who fought the Romans in 30 BCE and lost an eye.
Yes.
There's also in the Ghanaian princess, Abina Pokon, who created
Abena
a new
Poku.
Kingdom
Yes.
with a matrilineal system of succession.
Yes.
Could you just expand a bit on kind of how heritage worked and how, you know, we assume that all societies are quite patriarchal, and it turns out that quite a lot aren't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's often noted that patriarchy often was introduced by the colonial powers much later. Not all of Africa was patriarchal, but certainly key kingdoms like the Asante one was, and some people say Ashanti, but it's Asante. And Abena Poku, born around the 1700s, was an Asante princess, but then there was some internecine warfare, so she set off with her followers and set up a new kingdom in what is today Cote d'Ivoire. And, you know, again, she was a remarkable woman. But the Asante people as a whole took the matrilineal line of succession. And the wonderful Nana Rawlings, who's the widow of the late president, one of the former presidents of Ghana, Jerry Rawlings, has written a book called It Takes a Woman. And she was talking to me, and I quote her in the book because, of course, I use African sources. She said even today, when she goes back home, because she lives in Accra, when she goes to Kumasi, the capital of Asantiland, and she hears that there's been a birth in the community, she said people will say, oh, really, great. What was it, a boy or a girl? And if they say it was a girl, they're like, oh, fantastic, it's a girl. You know, not like in some, you know, European, including ours, where, you know, if there isn't a boy, then the estate will go to some distant male relative. You know, women had property rights and so on, and you mentioned the Kushite queens, Amani Renance, who fought the Romans, who by now had defeated the Egyptians and were governing Egypt. So in 30 BCE, she fought the Romans alongside her son, because often queens in the ancient kingdom of Kush, which is northern Sudan today, where my family are originally from, could rule as co-regents with either their husband or their sons. And they were so effective in fighting off the Romans, who never defeated northern Sudan, and she forced them to sign a treaty with her in 22 BCE, before Common Era. So, and you know, just as an aside, the queens of Kush were known as Kandakas, and the ancient Greeks and Romans mistakenly thought that Kandaka was the name of a woman, and it's from where we get the woman's name Candace from today. And in fact, in 2019, in April 2019, when the protest took place in Sudan to defeat the dictator Omar al-Bashir, there were a lot of women in the vanguard, and they styled themselves as Kandakas, you know, these soldier queens and so on. So it just shows you how, you know, history still resonates today.
And was this history that you already knew? Or how much of it was new to you? Because I felt reading it, so much of it was new to me. But of course, I'm not a historian and I don't know the history of Africa. But I'd probably be quite surprised about reading the history of Scotland. I don't know as well. But you know, how much of it was new to you?
Actually, I'm ashamed to say that a lot of it was. I mean, I've lived in the UK since I was 2 years of age. So I've had a British education, like most people here. But I was surprised that even my parents, who are educated, when I asked them what they knew about ancient Sudan, for instance, my mother said, oh, we were taken to see the pyramids once. And there are, incidentally, 1,000 pyramids in Sudan. There are 100 in Egypt. The ones in Sudan are not as big, but they and about 300 have preserved their superstructure. But my mother wouldn't have been able to have given me a date or any of the names of the kings and queens. I spoke to a former president of Nigeria. I said, what do you know about African history? And he said, you know what, Zainab, I could recite you the name of medieval kings and queens in England more than I could, you know, African kings and queens. And I, you know, Katie, I've developed a party trick now. I say to people, name me an African king or queen, and almost invariably people will say Tutankhamun, and then they'll say, but were the ancient Egyptians really African? And so, I mean, I was better than that, but I still learnt a great deal. And that really just reinforced in me this desire to, you know, bring to the fore a rich history that has really been occluded, neglected, or has been seen from the perspective, as I said, of the European victors. You know, there's a wonderful Southern African saying, which is, when the lions have historians, then the hunters will cease to be heroes. And I like that because, you know, one person's hero is another person's villain, aren't they really? And so for me, who had enjoyed, and I say enjoyed because obviously British education is one of the finest in the world, and, you know, I was at Oxford and then at London University for my postgraduate studies, and I wouldn't wish to denigrate British education at all. And this isn't about supplanting, it's about supplementing. It's about saying that a more diverse, inclusive lens on history, in my opinion, makes it a better history. And so that's what I set out to do. But it really is to fill in the gaps of our knowledge and to say to people, look, African history is part of our global story.
Mm. And you mentioned just a minute ago, are ancient Egyptians Africans? That's something you pick up in the book. It's really interesting, that thought of, and why do you think it is that people would ask that question? Why do we not think of ancient Egypt as an African nation or state or country or part of Africa?
So you're right, I do touch on that. I mean, each chapter, there are 18, but each chapter I start off with a contemporary debate to try and say to you, this is why this particular aspect of history matters. So the chapter on the history of the Benin Kingdom, I mentioned the Benin, you know, statues and reparation, restitution, the slavery, I talk about reparations, but you're quite right, on the ancient Egyptian chapter, I looked at this issue as to why people want to say that the ancient Egyptians were somehow not part of Africa. And you hear this even in Egypt itself, and I think there are a number of reasons, and you see it replicated also in other parts of Africa, the great monuments of Great Zimbabwe. People couldn't believe that indigenous Africans built this amazing, sprawling stone complex. And I think there is a feeling that Africans could not have created such an amazing, glittering civilization. I think that's one view. Egypt, obviously, has a Mediterranean coast, and people, and right from the start, it was exposed to influences from Western Asia and Southern Europe. And so people feel that it was somehow, you know, influences from beyond Africa that contributed to the building of this great civilization. And then I think a third reason is that the Arabs conquered Egypt very early on in 640 Common Era, CE or AD. And they brought with them their own ideology. And as I touch on in the book in chapter 9, there was an Eastern slave trade perpetrated by the Arabs who enslaved more Africans than during the transatlantic slave trade. Major differences between the two trades. And I think that because they mixed from such an early age with the ancient Egyptians, with Egyptians, that they acquired some of that ideology that rather denigrated Africans and saw them as, you know, a bit inferior. So I think for those reasons, people put ancient Egypt apart from Africa, but I say ancient Egypt is an African culture. If you've visited it and you've been to Luxor, which is, you know, or Karnak, Thebes, the old religious center, is very far south, going towards the border of Sudan. Abu Simbel is practically the original site on the border of northern Sudan. You know, miles away, hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the Mediterranean coast. It's not a Mediterranean civilization at its heart. It's an African one.
And in the book, I should say, part of the wonder of it is Zainab's travels through Africa to bring us these stories, as well as, I'd say, and I don't mean this critically, I think this is good, it's very much a journalist book in the sense that you're laying out the stories, the facts, the arguments. You're not taking a side on topics. Although I would say, just talking about the Arab slave trade, is it's interesting because I did think, actually, when you talk about the fact that there is this silence around that, that actually, you know, that hasn't really been acknowledged by that part of the world in a way that perhaps we could say it is being acknowledged by those descendants and perpetrators of the transatlantic slave trade. And that felt to me a bit of a call to arms, or at least how do you see that and how you view that bit of history?
Yeah, I mean, I don't particularly take sides. As I say, it's not a rant. It's not in any way do I want to be engaged in the so-called culture wars. There are other people doing that, and I'm not interested in that. I'm just writing a book which is, hey, didn't you know? It's revelatory. It's interesting. Having said that, I mean, it's not really my view as such. I am, on the whole, acting as a kind of intercessor between the African academics. I'm really, you know, bringing them their voice. So where I do venture on an opinion, it is their view and this conspiracy of silence about the Eastern slave trade was said to me by one of Africa's foremost polymaths, Professor Augustine Hole, Cameroonian-born academic, who said, you know, the Arabs are in denial about this slave trade that they and their partners perpetrated. And so I do want to stimulate debate, and I say throughout that, you know, it is a revelatory book, and therefore to talk at length about this particular slave trade about which people don't know. People do say, oh, well, you know, don't blame us all for the transatlantic slave trade. The Arabs were at it much earlier. I mean, that's true.
Yeah. Yes, I think you have a fact that 14 million Africans were shipped through that trade between 7th and 19th century.
Yes.
But just for people who don't know much about it, what was happening?
So, I mean, the enslavement of Africans by the Arabs and their partners. I mean, the Arabs didn't just trade in enslaved Africans. They also took enslaved people from other parts of the world, Asia, India, and so on. But they took mostly from Africa. And as you say, quite rightly, began around the 7th, 8th century and finished in the late 19th century. About 14 million were transported, predominantly 10 million across the Indian Ocean, some across the Red Sea from east, you know, going across to Arabia, and then some in the trans-Saharan trade from sub-Saharan Africa to the Arab families in the north, because the Arabs had conquered North Africa really by the 700s. Practically all of North Africa had fallen to the Arabs. So those were the three routes. The transatlantic slave trade started much later, in earnest, around 1510, the Portuguese and the Spanish at first, and then the Brits came in, 1562, and then in earnest in the 1600s by England. And that was about 12.5 million people. But they differed dramatically in that the Eastern slave trade, I don't like to say the Arab slave trade because people don't say the European slave trade. They talk about one as a geographical, you know, the transatlantic slave trade, which slightly sanitizes, you know, culpability in a way. So I will say the Indian Ocean slave trade because that accounted for most of it. The Indian Ocean slave trade, women were preferred as concubines, sex slaves, essentially. The transatlantic slave trade favored men because they were needed for the backbreaking work on the plantations in South America, the Caribbean, and far fewer went to North America. There were different jobs. I mean, slavery is awful, and you know, the so-called Arab slave trade, they could be employed to work on the salt marshes of what would be Iraq today, clove plantations, but they also had the opportunity to work as soldiers, as scribes, as one particularly awful thing was as eunuchs. A good proportion were castrated, a horrible operation. Very few survived it. And pearl divers, you know, and their eardrums would be ruptured and so on. And the transatlantic slave trade was mostly plantations, as I said, and domestic servants. But one curious difference is that if an Arab man sired a child with an enslaved African woman, that child would be born free and the mother would be liberated to look after it. And indeed, that child could rise to hold a very high position, even become a royal. In the transatlantic slave trade, on the whole, if a man had a child with an enslaved African woman, that child would be put to work like everybody else as a slave and the mother would continue to work. So that was one crucial difference, which is why today, if you look at the Gulf, you will see, you know, that mixture of even members of, you know, Gulf royal families will display, you know, different features and so on.
And I know whenever I do stories about, usually around contested objects in the cultural arena and, you know, restitution, if I don't mention it, and usually I do, if it's relevant, but, you know, we sometimes get an email saying, but you're not telling the full story. You know, the Asantes, for example, were slavers. They were just as complicit in slavery as the transatlantic, you know, people behind that. One of the things that's really interesting and moving in your book is just about the guilt and shame that is felt in certain parts of Africa over that, over the African participation in slavery.
Mm. And sure, and that's another area where I think there should be a greater debate. It's beginning to happen. But certainly, if you talk to African Americans, or as some of them prefer to be called, Black Americans, some will say to you, yeah, we're very happy with our African roots and we'd like to go and rediscover them, and they'll go to Ghana and look at the slave forts and so on. They're in a minority. A lot of them will say, you know what, don't really want to have anything to do with Africa. We're black Americans. Something happened to us in that middle passage when we went to North America. I mean, very few enslaved Africans actually went to North America. It's just because it's the most powerful and richest of the diaspora, and they speak English, of course. I mean, the biggest diaspora is in Brazil. But and they will say to you, you know, we feel ambivalent about going to Africa because these people, their ancestors enslaved ours. And there are also people in Africa who were victims of indigenous internal slavery. But indigenous internal slavery was very, very different from either the transatlantic or the eastern slave trade. You know, people were much more members of the community. They could marry, they could have children. They weren't necessarily slaves for life. They might just be paying off a debt or whatever.
And you're saying they weren't viewed as intrinsically inferior.
Exactly. It wasn't based on the ideology of racism, which ascribed to them an inferiority. So indigenous internal slavery, I mean, as I say, slavery is not a picnic wherever it is, but there is also that debate about people living in Africa now who their ancestors or their forefathers and foremothers were actually, you know, trading in slaves internally.
And when you think now about the impact, it's difficult to say the impact on Africa because it's obviously so vast and so many places, but there's so many things that come out of the book in terms of obviously the economic impact of slavery, gender imbalance of those left behind, population size, and then just tiny little things that mean so much, like in Ghana, where the legacy of the housing in those areas where people were taken as slaves. Just tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I do like this fact that, you know, as we all see, history is, it can't just be consigned to the past. You know, it not only explains the past, but it also informs the present, and it can shape the future. And it's surprising if you go to parts of Ghana where people, you know, were kidnapped and basically human trafficked as enslaved people. To this day, people will say in hushed tones, don't go and live in that part because that's an area where people were just taken. And the homes can sometimes be built quite high on sticks so that with very, very small apertures for the opening so that people can't peer inside and think, oh, there's some choice young people living there. I'm going to cart them off to be sold.
It's still like
as
that.
Chattel slavery. They're not built anymore like that, but you do see some homes like that. And that was told me by, you know, my wonderful cultural expert who was taking me around. But certainly people speak in hushed tones. And also people speak in hushed tones in Ghana, those who are visibly dual heritage or mixed, because, of course, a great deal of rape went on as the enslaved African women were being held, waiting to be shipped off across the Atlantic. A good number of them would be raped. The Portuguese had a different system, which is sometimes they'd leave her if she became, you know, pregnant and not take her off and she might stay where she is. And so you see a number of people who obviously, you know, much fairer skinned and so on. And again, it's a bit of a taboo to mention it because it says, you know, your foremothers were essentially raped and so on. So you see the evidence today.
I did a story recently about Ghana because the British Museum and the Victoria and Albert have sent back, I don't know if anyone saw the story, but some really incredible pieces that were taken during various Anglo-Ashanti wars. Court regalia that means a lot to the Asantehene. I didn't realise, I keep using the term Asantehene through the last 2 years of doing this story, and it was only by reading your book I realised that means King of Kings. I just thought it meant the Asante King, but it actually means the King of Kings.
He's the King of Kings. There's some minor kings in the Asante Kingdom, yes.
But that, you know, and they're going on loan because, that's how it has to be for the British Museum and the Victoria and Albert, because the law says that they can't do anything other than loan them. But I was very aware that the government of Ghana couldn't make that deal because a loan of something that you believe belongs to you is very complicated, whereas the Asantehene was happy to do this deal. And you do... I wonder where you think we're going in terms of, I don't know, those arguments about, well, will it mean... When you walk around the British Museum and you see things from Benin or Ghana or wherever it might be, is there stuff from Sudan, probably?
Yes, there is.
Do you think... It's great it's here. Do you think it should go back? It's very complicated, all this stuff. I'm aware of that.
Yes. I mean, I think you have to look at everything on a case-by-case basis. But I think the debate really, in a sense, has moved on now that most people in the cultural sphere accept that some return of, in some shape or form, there's the argument, in a sense, has been won. And it's just working out, you know, on what basis. Is it a long-term loan? Is it, you know, short-term loan or whatever? I mean, there's a very remarkable study that was commissioned by the French government in 2018 that said that more, at least 90% of African artifacts and art is held outside the continent. And I do think there should be a special case made for Africa because, yeah, we all know the Mona Lisa Italian is in the Louvre and so on, but let's face it, the Italians have got loads of stuff. It doesn't matter. We all go off to Italy and, you know, you don't know which way to turn if you're in Venice and looking at all the marvellous treasures. But when you take and leave only 10% in the continent, I think the balance is too skewed that way. And so, and also I think people should remember that it's not just art for art's sake. These are historic documents in a way. You know, the Benin bronzes are not just bronzes to be admired. They, you know, tell you tales of major battles, of what this particular Oba, that's the name for the king of the Benin kingdom, you know, what this particular Oba did. You can see the way he's interacting with the Portuguese mercenaries, so you know that you can date when he might have used Portuguese mercenaries and so on and so forth. And in fact, the Benin language, the Edo language, word for to remember is to cast in bronze, which shows you that these are memorials. These are, you know, it's their history. So you're not just depriving people of art, which is, ooh, ah, that's pretty. It's actually their culture, their soul. And that's why I think that, you know, we will see things go back. And often I think people will say, oh God, look what's happening in Timbuktu. You know, if we return things there, look, the extremists over around that city and, you know, Iraq or whatever in the world. And they use that to discredit, you know, the return of all objects. And to your point about when you go to the British Museum and you want to see things, of course, but a large number, in fact, the vast majority of these artifacts from Africa are kept in storage. So I think the answer is what the king of the Benin kingdom, the Oba of Benin, said to me was, we want to keep some stuff out there to act as ambassadors for our culture, to counter this idea that we were just savages and so on, that we produced this exquisite artwork, but we'd like some back.
That you talk in the book about the myth of primitive Africa.
Mm.
Can you just reflect on that a bit and where did that come from?
I mean, I think that, and I don't touch on this in the book, but we know that, you know, the science of racism and the inferiority ascribed to people of African descent is something that really took shape in the second half of the 1800s with, obviously, the work of Darwin. He didn't do it directly, but, you know, when he said that we are descended from the gorilla and the chimpanzee, or rather, you know, our line diverged 7 million years ago, but we originated in Africa because that's where the gorilla and the chimpanzee exist. And so people, you know, started thinking, when you go to Africa, that's the missing link. You'll see the missing link there. And even now you go to a football match and you'll hear people make, you know, monkey noises and so on. So it's remarkable how persistent that view has been. And so then you had Francis Galton, who invented eugenics to say that, you know, people of African descent are inferior, and they did all the chronology, you know, shape of the head and so on. So I think that, and then it was bolstered by the anthropologists, the missionaries who were the handmaidens of the colonial officers. So you get people like E.B. Tyler, who talks about primitive cultures and says that their religion is animism, which is a term coined by him coming from the Latin anima, meaning soul or breath, and saying that, you know, the Africans worship objects which they ascribe a soul to every object, which is not the case. And, you know, ancestor worship. So all these ideas really took hold and became formalized in the late 19th century and really, in a way, have persisted for a long time.
And that's part of the wonder of your book, is sort of the incredible riches, the facts, the richness of facts in this book about, I don't know, everyone from... I was very pleased because I mentioned this person to my son the other day and he said, yeah, we've learned about him in school. Massa Musa I.
Oh, yeah.
14th century king of the Malian Empire. tell us about him, because he's got some pretty great claim to fame.
I'm glad your son's heard about him.
Yes, he had.
I mean, some people may have. Mansa is the name for the kings of the Mali Empire, which was founded in 1235 by a soldier called Sundiata Keita, and Mansa Musa I is the best known of the kings of Mali. He was his nephew. Sundiata Keita wasn't Muslim, but Mansa Musa was. He was born in 1280, and he died in 1332, but in 1324 to 25, he's best known for this amazing pilgrimage he embarked on. And he set off, you know, with 12,000 members of his own household, 600 personal servants, 60,000 porters carrying all his goods, you know, his food and all his stuff, and about 100 camels carrying up to 20 tons of gold. So the Mali Empire was fabulously wealthy. And he went to Mecca, and on his way back, he stopped at Cairo again. He stopped there on the way out and stopped on the way back again. Very generous man, spent so lavishly, gave away so much gold that the price of gold plummeted by 25%. It lost its value and didn't recover it for more than a decade. And by, you know, reliable accounts, he is the richest individual ever to have lived. He'd be worth about $430 billion US today. But why I like the story of Mansa Musa, apart from the fact that, you know, he's depicted in a map by a Catalan cartographer in 1375, well after his death, as one of the most important people in the world, wearing his gold crown, holding his golden staff, wearing silk, is because it shows how Africa was integrated, even in what we call the medieval period, into the global economy, to the extent that the actions of this one king in West Africa, the Mali Empire encompassed several countries in what we call the Sahel today, not just the country of Mali. And, you know, the idea that there are those who make history and those who stand on the sidelines of history, very much putting the Africans in the latter group, is not true. This is a man, you know, whose actions had an impact on the world economy. So I like that story for that reason.
And how long did you spend researching it? I mean, I was quite jealous as I read the book. I was like, oh, she's in another amazing place looking at something fabulous. But were you just going and coming back, or how did you do it?
I mean, I was still working as a broadcaster still on news and current affairs. So it really was a very taxing period in my life, because I didn't just go to capital cities. I would, you know, traverse huge countries. I mean, I went to the three biggest countries in Africa, Algeria, the DRC, and then the Sudan, in that order. Sudan was the biggest until 2011, when South Sudan seceded and Sudan dropped to number three. So just going across these countries. So it took me seven years to go to more than 30 African countries and to go across. And so I did the series in two parts, and the last episode was broadcast on the BBC International channel, BBC World, in 2020, and then in July 2020, soon after that, I put it on YouTube. So, and then the writing of the book was a lot easier, because I'd already thought about, you know, what I wanted to do, and I'd already spoken to people and could use their vision and their perspective. But I also wanted to talk about the splendor and the beauty of the continent, and to mention monuments, you know, where I could. So that's why I do mention the fact that, you know, I'm here meeting Lucy or whatever, you know.
And I am in a minute going to take questions if anyone's got any, so start thinking if you haven't. But I could keep asking questions for ages. And I suppose we should turn to the future. You talk in the book about, you coin with reference or homage or apology to Nelson Mandela, but about the long walk to freedom for Africa. And I wonder how you see the future of the continent and the countries within.
Got to mention Mandela somewhere, isn't it? It's a bit cliched, I know, but still. So I think that, you know, this is where history is useful. If you take the long lens of history, as opposed to the short-term view of Africa, you'll have cause to be much more optimistic. Short-term view of Africa, I'm not starry-eyed about it. There's a great deal that's awful that's going on, not least of all, you know, the country of my birth, Sudan, where the US now says 150,000 people have died in this senseless war between the two factions. But I think even the medium to long-term view, and by that I would say maybe 20 to 25 years, you've still got some of the world's fastest growing economies in Africa. And the reason I'm optimistic about the continent is for several reasons. First of all, it's the youngest continent in the world. You know, if you look at the figures, Japan, 49, Italy, 47 years of age is the average, you know, average age. The United Kingdom, 42. France, 42. The USA and China, 38. You can go on and on. Africa, 18. Some countries are as young, the average age is 15. You know, you cast your mind back to when you were young, that's when you're most productive, when you're ambitious, when you want to acquire, when you want to build. And also, the world is becoming increasingly technological and digitally, you know, advanced and so on. And the Africans are becoming better educated, more urbanized, the young, and they're very digitally savvy. So that's one reason why. And I think that their underdevelopment also puts them in a good position to really maximize the benefits of the technological revolutions. You know, we've got our creaking mature economies, you know, our transport system, our aging housing stock, our sewers don't work properly. These people can build with the latest, you know, rust-proof material and all the rest of it. So they can really capitalize on what technology brings us. And then another reason is that Africa has a strong ace in its hand. It has a huge amount of the natural resources that the world needs, the earth minerals, the lithium, the cobalt. You know, 70% of the cobalt mining in the world takes place in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And, you know, if the new mineral revolution is properly managed by the African leaders, which is a big ask, then I think that Africa would be very well placed to really, you know, benefit economically from that. So I suppose
that's the question, isn't it? Will it be? I mean, you talk, of course, about the corruption and the fact that too much of the money has already ended up in the hands of, you know, despotic or corrupt leaders and their foreign accessories.
Of course. Thank you for saying the foreign accessories, because people always talk about corruption in Africa, but, you know, you can't clap with one hand. And let's face it, you know, Western corporations have a great deal of culpability with that. We know what's happened with, you know, the profit shifting of Apple and, you know, I'm not libeling anybody because it's all out in the public domain and so on, you know, not paying taxes and so on. And so, you know, when you think of the figures, I don't mention this in the book, but, you know, Africa receives $53 billion a year in what's now called external finance, i.e. aid, but it loses $100 billion a year in illicit financial flows. And that is corrupt leaders taking the money out of the continent, but where do they put it? They don't leave it in Africa. It's in Western institutions, financial institutions. So, you know, double the amount. So, yes, I mean, the African leaders, governance is an issue. The colonial legacy economically dealt Africa a very bad hand economically, but no question that post-independent African leaders have made a bad hand worse. There are some exceptions, but sadly, there are not. But the other reason I'm very optimistic is young people are not taking this lying down. I mean, if you see what's happening in Kenya now with these youth-led protests against the finance bill that the President William Ruto wants to introduce, they're like, OK, we would understand if you were going to tax us and remove the subsidies from, you know, basic goods and so on, but we are not convinced that you are using the funds that you have at your disposal in a reasonable way. You know, he's a multi-millionaire with hundreds of millions, and so people don't trust the government and so on, but they're protesting. It was the young people of Sudan who removed a dictator after 30 years, and the trend shows you that young Africans are demonstrating using civil disobedience. They're also, you know, statistics show us much less likely to fall back on their community, or sometimes people say tribal affiliations. They're much more, you know, nation focused. So that's why I think in the medium and long term, I am optimistic about Africa. And I mean, the population's going to double by 2050 from 1.4 billion now, which means a quarter of the world's workforce, producers, consumers are going to be African. And all those aging populations, well, we see it already now, you know, with our hospitals, our care homes and so on. If it wasn't for a lot of African migrants coming in, you know, we talk about migrants, but 80% of Africans who are migrants stay within the continent. That 20% who don't include what Africans would refer to as the brain drain. You know, doctors, there used to be a saying that there were more nurses from Malawi working in Manchester than in Malawi itself. And there are more Nigerian doctors, psychiatrists certainly working in the UK than in Nigeria and so on and so forth. But, you know, people don't see that that side. And it's all about inverting the telescope and trying to see things through the lens of Africans, because that's how they discuss things.
Has anyone got any questions? Because I could keep going. Oh, look, there's one gentleman with his
hand. All passing out from the heat.
And another one just here afterwards.
I was lucky to spend 3 years in Cameroon in the late 80s. Cameroon's almost the one country you don't mention your book, which is sad because it actually is Africa in miniature. Every geography, people, religion in Africa is in Cameroon. And you didn't mention Cameroon's gorillas. But my question is, I've read recently that they think humankind started in Cameroon. That was DNA traces. Had you heard that?
I mean, I've heard, well, first of all, just to say on your point about countries, remember that apart from Egypt and maybe Ethiopia a bit, there were no African countries as we know them today until the Berlin Conference in 1885, when, as you know, lines were drawn arbitrarily by the European powers. And so it's not a history of modern Africa. I don't start the book in 1884. With the Berlin Conference. So that's why I don't really name countries. So I do have people coming up saying, you didn't do Malawi or whatever, but I definitely did do north, south, east, west, central regions as best I could. So I don't mention countries for that reason, but certainly Cameroon is one I didn't mention in any shape or form, even in the epilogue. But in terms of when I said the debate is settled about the fact that we all came out of Africa, there still is debate about which part of Africa, but still, the overwhelming pieces of the jigsaw, and it's about a 600-piece jigsaw, and we've got about 30 pieces, if that, I would say that most arguments still move towards the eastern part, but more latterly, in the last few years, because of the discovery of some bones in Irhoud in North Africa, near Morocco, that now there is an idea that maybe Homo sapiens sapiens, us, originated in different parts of Africa more or less at the same time. But most people would still, you know, veer towards the east and perhaps a bit of the north. But there is a big fight, you know, the South Africans saying it, the Naledi bone discoveries, you know, my bones are older than your bones and so on. So there's a little bit of a competition. But I used African sources, and you're right to say paleontologists, you know, a lot of it is detective work. But I used Dr. Richard Leakey, my late friend, the great Kenyan paleontologist, who we all miss dearly, as the backbone of that first chapter, and also Professor Augustine Hole, Cameroonian-born paleontologist, and Johannes Haile Selassie, who's Ethiopian. But I accept that it still is. There's a lot of guesswork involved.
I'm going to take somebody at the back, but then there was this woman here who had her hand up first, who's got her hat on just here, so she could go second after the person at the back, please.
Person at the back. Zainab, please, could you say a little bit about the relationship between China and Africa? You've mentioned a lot of the other Europeans, Arabs, and American corporations. But in my limited travels in Africa, I've noted a visceral dislike for the Chinese. How would you interpret that, please?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't look at modern Africa because I didn't want to do the kind of thing where, you know, you could pick up a perfectly good article in The Economist or The Financial Times, Big Read or whatever, about China's role in Africa. But what I would say is this about China's role in Africa. They started at the end of the last millennium to start their China program, as it were, under Deng Xiaoping. And then President Hu picked it up and President Xi. And it wasn't until about 2012 that the Europeans and the North Americans suddenly realized that the Chinese really had this massive program going on in Africa. They have stolen a march a bit on the Europeans. They're very good on their yen diplomacy. They set up their Confucius Institutes that they, you know, spend money on. They built the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa. But on the whole, the Chinese deal bilaterally with a few countries. I do think that there's a great deal of exaggeration about China's role in Africa. I think the complaints that you refer to is that on the whole, it is true that Africa has been an exporter of raw materials to China, principally oil and gas, like from Angola and so on, which is one of its biggest trading partners. And only about 13 countries, 1/3, have a trade surplus with China. About 30 have a trade deficit. Why? Because Africa sells raw materials to China and it imports the finished goods. A lot of, you know, manufactured products which do undersell Africans, you know, attempts to industrialize and make clothes, textiles, and so on. And that does cause resentment. The Chinese also are known to use, you know, bring some of their own labor in and so on, but they've got a lot better. You know, we're not at the stage where Michael Sata, former president of Zambia, ran on an anti-China program when he was platformed, when he was trying to become president of Zambia. We've moved on from when the Chinese would build a hospital in Angola and it would wash away, you know, in floods. But I do think that that China's role in Africa is a bit exaggerated. If you look at the statistics, Africa accounts for about 5% of China's global trade, only 5%, and that represents 15% of Africa's global trade. China is Africa's biggest trading partner. It overtook the US in 2009, but as a bloc, the EU is by far the biggest, and North America. So bilaterally, yes, China is a big player. The infrastructure projects, sometimes if you look below the headlines, you'll see that actually a lot of these infrastructure projects that are so-called Chinese, it's just China bidding openly, has no equity in these infrastructure projects. And it's just because people see and they think, oh, it's the Chinese building something again. But actually, there's been an international tender and they've just underbid everybody because they know Africa well. So I would say China is just, you know, one player now in a world which is more multipolar, where you've got the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Gulf states. And I think on the whole, that's a good thing for Africa because it has more suitors.
Let's go with
this. I mean, I could go on and on about China in Africa.
We're going to try and get a few more questions in.
Thank you. As a journalist, what's your view about the state of the media in Africa and its potential for being independent and free, since its history has been one of enormous state control?
Mm. Yes, I mean, sadly, most, and you know, we work for the BBC, you're still with the BBC, and I still am sort of loosely connected. There's a difference between being a state broadcaster and a national broadcaster. The BBC is a national broadcaster. It doesn't do the bidding of the government, or at least it resists insofar as it can, although obviously the government can appoint the chairman and so on and so forth, but chairman of the board. But Africa takes state TV seriously. That is often an extension of the presidential office. The president's gone here, gone there, and so on. And I was once chair of something called Article 19, which part of its mandate was to obviously promote the 19th article of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And we had something called the Harari Declaration, Harari Principles, whereby, you know, we would try to have programs to show journalists how, you know, they could do independent reporting and so on. It's difficult because you still find that most of the resources are going into state media. The creative industries are different. You've got independent channels there for, you know, entertainment and so on, particularly in Nigeria. But I will say this, the technological revolution has not bypassed Africa, and now you have citizen journalism in earnest in Africa. You know, it's very hard to rig an election now in Africa. Somebody will capture something, you know, ballot boxes being stuffed or somebody being beaten up because they're voting the wrong way. Somebody will capture it on a mobile phone and it will proliferate. So I think that the role of social media and citizen journalism has helped redress that balance of the tight state control that you have. But there are flourishing media in you know, Kenya, for all its problems, has still got the kind of newspapers, The Nation, so on, which are critical of the president, you know, or the government of the day. So it depends.
We've got time, I think, for one more at the back. I'm afraid I can't see whether it's
Thank
a man
you.
Or a woman.
Thank you. I was just wondering on your travels round over the years that you've seen the climate change impact on the environment and the way people are living there, and as their great ideas of mass migration, because it will be intolerable to live in certain parts of Africa.
Yes, certainly. I have seen that, of course, you know, the desertification, people trying to eke out a living from inhospitable land and so on. But what I will say is this about the climate change debate, and I don't talk about this in my book, but I'll say it now. I think that there's a parallel debate going on in the world. We talk about the climate debate in a very different way from Africans. So in the West, in you know, middle-income, rich countries, we talk about, you know, don't use your light so much to get a new heat pump, don't use air conditioning. Greta Thunberg will say, take the train, don't take the plane. 1% of Africans have ever been on an aeroplane. How can you talk about mitigation in Africa when the continent as a whole accounts for 3% of global carbon emissions? Strip away the more industrialized north of Africa, that figure drops to 0.5 percentage point contribution to global warming. How can you mitigate 0.5 percentage point? So in Africa, the debate about climate change is adaptation, not mitigation. And adaptation is, you know, you can't tell the sky to bring rain. You can't make the rain fall. So adaptation is the key. Technology is important. There's no technology transfer. There's not enough money. Africa needs trillions and trillions of dollars. And you see these pledges, but nothing really materializes. And the other thing is, you know, where it's a very different debate. Africa, people talk about the transition to renewable energy. How do you have a transition if 640 million people in Africa do not have access to power? I've seen too many children doing their homework under candlelight. You know, it's a debate which is doesn't make sense. People say, you know, retreat from fossil fuels. And the Africans will say to you, look, we're so excited we found some oil. And then they'll discover, actually, no, we're not going to have any investment in oil because Glasgow, the COP at Glasgow, said no more investment in new fossil fuels. Yet you'll see the British government will say, North Sea oil, we're going to find some new fields. The Germans reopening their disused coal plants and so on. So, and they don't have the technology to manage the nuclear power that France relies on nuclear power for its electricity and so on. So the Africans say, look, hang on, this climate debate, we're copping it, and yet we contributed least of all. And we're being told to do something which nobody has ever achieved, which is to industrialise, i.e. modernise our economies. I don't mean just build industry through renewable energy. Having said that, very quickly, Africa's doing remarkable things with renewable energy. 92% of Kenya's electricity is through renewable sources. They've rolled out, you know, buses, which are electric buses in Nairobi and so on. So they do a great deal.
I'm afraid that is all we've got time for. I'd love to take more questions, but I know they're very strict on time here, and you're probably all a bit hot.
I'm sure.
We are too. Thank you so much to you all for being here for an hour, but mainly thank you so much to Zeynep Badawi.
Thank you.
And, of course, thank you to our sponsors. Buy the book. It's really good. I'm going to keep thinking about the woman, the queen, escaping by using
abseiling,
the vines, abseiling
yes.
across
the vine.
The precipice on a vine.
Thank you.
But
thank
there's
you
lots more where that came from.